Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Lotus Eaters for today, the 22nd of September 2022. I am joined again by Dominic Frisby. How are you?
Very well, thank you. 22/9/22 is today's date.
There we go. Nice up with synchronicity. So we'll be speaking about today the Patriot Act 2.0, because the Biden administration have decided to spy on you again, how PayPal have cancelled the Free Speech Union and other dissident groups in the UK, and how British soaps are actually brainwashing you, and by you, I mean the normal people that still watch terrestrial television, mistaken though they are. So I suppose we'll get into the first topic, shall we?
Let's do it.
So a recent series of lawsuits, interviews and leaks have proven that the Biden administration are outsourcing a sort of Silicon Valley Patriot Act 2.0 to subcontractors in social media. In this segment, we're going to walk through just some of the recent examples of the permanent, unelected state surveilling innocent Americans, just so you can show your more critical, Bush-hating relatives that the same reprehensible acts enacted by the people that got us into the Iraq War are now being done by the Democrats as well. It's not just party-specific, it's across parties that they just kind of want to spy on you. So let's start with remarks by President Biden at the United We Stand summit, because the Democrats have said endlessly we're trying to bring the country together. Does Biden feel like much of a unifying force? I mean, I don't really think the giant red death to MAGA speech did all that much, but he says here,
we're bringing you together as long as you agree with us.
Yes, yeah, we'll bring you together after we've cut your head off and we'll refuse it just for the burial. We have to stand united against hate-fueled violence because it's real and you know it better than anyone to affirm that an attack on one group is literally an attack on all of us. Jill and I, my wife Jill, traveled to Buffalo to grieve with families and deliver a message from deep in our nation's soul. In America, evil will not win. It will not prevail. Hate will not prevail. And white supremacists will not have the last word. And this venom and violence cannot be the story of our time. So we have convened this summit to make clear what the story of our time must be. It has to be a story in which each and every one of us has a vital role to play. A story with this message from the White House, united, united we stand. So then he goes on to repeat the incredibly divisive lie that he ran for president because of Donald Trump saying that Charlottesville, the Nazis were very fine people on both sides, even though we know for a fact that he said, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists because they'll be condemned totally. And he was just talking about the people protesting the fact that we shouldn't topple statues, which is a fairly principled stance. The White House then this press release then editorializes his speech. Because he says, every other nation is based on ethnicity, geography. In America, we're based on an idea, literally, not figuratively, an idea. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all, and then they put in parentheses, women and then it goes back to men, are created equal, endowed by their, and that's their was edited, creator, etc. It's quite interesting that again, he's done the tail off of, we hold these truths to be self-evident. You know the thing. I don't understand how you can say you're a unifying American president and then can't even get through the Declaration of Independence or any words from the Constitution, but amnesia doesn't seem to be the least of Biden's worries.
I was going to say, you haven't put in repeat the line, end of quote.
Or the best one, that's American can be defined by a single word. He then says, the idea of America is that it guarantees everyone is treated with dignity and equality. An idea that ensures an inclusive, multiracial democracy. An idea that we give no safe harbor, none, to hate. Well, America doesn't treat all people equally, and nowhere does, because that's a preaching of moral apathy. We don't treat our criminals equally, for example. But the Democrats seem to be doing so, because they've just scrapped, for example, cash bail in Chicago for second-degree murder. So they're just letting murderers out on the street. So they really are treating people equally. Everyone gets out, even if you've killed someone. So then Biden runs through a list of aggrieved groups. So he starts to build this constituency of exactly who he's targeting here, who needs to be, who we all need to unite behind, who needs to be this new aristocratic class telling us how to live. Look, I'm not naive. Kamala and I traveled to Atlanta to grieve with Asian American residents. Violence against the community rose during the pandemic. Too many people fearful just walking the streets in America, mainly in San Francisco. And we can't talk about the ethnicity of the attackers of Asian Americans because that would be white supremacist, of course. Jewish high holidays approach. Families will gather for reflection under the shadow of the rise of anti-Semitism in just 4 years. Again, look at New York. The ethnicities of the attacker don't quite fit the white supremacist narrative, do they? Just 4 years after the attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the deadliest attack of anti-Semitism in our nation's history. Of course, wrong. This summer, 31 white supremacists in Idaho were stopped from unleashing hateful violence just before they reached a pride celebration, a threat following a record year of violence against transgender Americans. Ken, can't talk about the Pulse nightclub shooting because that would raise the perpetrator doesn't quite fit the box of the narrative here. Today, with the fall semester starting, we're joined by presidents of historically black colleges and universities who should be able to focus on providing the best experience possible for their students, but instead are having to worry about more bomb threats against their institutions. Again, 2020 Summer of Love. How many firebombs were thrown by BLM rioters? But we can't talk about that. Too often, Native American, disabled Americans face harassment, discrimination, violence and victimization. Unfortunately, such hate-fueled violence and threats are not new to America. There is a through line of hate from massacres of indigenous people to the original sin of slavery, the terror of the Klan, to anti-immigration violence against the Irish, Italians, Chinese, Mexicans, and so many others laced throughout our history. There's a through line of violence against religious groups, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, anti-Mormon, anti-Muslim, anti-Hindu, anti-Sikh. Look, folks, and all that through line of hate never goes away. It only hides. Again, how can you claim to be a patriotic, unifying American president when you're just saying my entire nation is steeped in the original sin of bigotry?
It's so, the framing of this argument is so dishonest. I wonder why I get wound up when I watch some politicians speak. And when you actually analyze a speech like this and you see, like, nobody talks about English Americans.
Mm.
And the sort of subtext here is that the English Americans are the perpetrators of all this, because they're the one guys that can't possibly be a victim of anything. And if they ever are a victim, it's because of what happened in the past and it's justified. And it's really concerning.
They're the only subgroup excluded from equal moral consideration.
Well, yes. Either everyone's treated equally or they're not.
Yeah. And so much for Biden preaching that, huh? So then he claims white supremacy is the leading domestic terror threat, and then also that silence is violence. You know, as a result, our own intelligence agencies in the United States of America have determined domestic terrorism rooted in white supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat to our homeland today.
Really?
Yeah, never mind Antifa people running up to people in the street and gunning them down or hitting them with cars, as we saw yesterday.
White supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat to our homeland today.
Yeah.
White supremacy. That's just not true.
No, only if you live in an ideological bubble.
How many white supremacist suicide bombers are there?
Or actually mass shootings. They've excluded gang and drive-by shootings from the classification of mass shootings. But if you include those, again, the ethnicity of the perpetrators is not convenient for the narrative, let's say. And it seems to be a consequence of Democrat cities.
But if they're so dishonest.
Neighbourhoods.
Sorry about that. But if they're so dishonest about this and about the way they frame the argument, and there's this one group. I mean, the long-term damage to social cohesion. No wonder so many people are so angry. And no wonder so many people are put into more extreme philosophical positions than they would otherwise adopt, because they're pushed there.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
I think it's an intentional stoking of the flames just because they believe their side can win. That's, for example, when the postmodernists...
I don't think they even realise what they're doing.
I do. I don't think we can attribute incompetence at this point, maybe to Biden, of course, because he doesn't have a brain left. It's mainly rotted away. But a lot of his handlers are steeped in critical race theory ideologies, and they intentionally raise racial consciousness to then incite a Marxist revolution along race-based lines. So they're intentionally trying to kickstart an ethnic conflict. And so when you take away the tool of dialogue as a mediating tool between groups, so we can talk to each other, where we can settle our differences, where, you know, we can make jokes across racial lines, because that is true equality, as you would say, then the only way of resolving a conflict is violence. And they know that, and I think they're pushing us there because they think their side will win. And I don't want a race war, funnily enough, because I'm not one of these evil, insane people. I don't think white supremacy is the biggest terror threat, because I think you guys are manufacturing the problem, because, funnily enough, not a lot of white people feel kinship with their fellow white people. It's just a strange worldview.
You know, as you can tell, I'm white, and I talk to a lot of white people, and I don't think I have ever met anyone. I must have met someone at some point in my life, but I don't think I've ever sat down with anyone and he's just sat there and made the case to me for white supremacy.
No.
I mean, I'm sure that person exists somewhere, but nobody's ever said that.
I've encountered one or two, and they're instantly irksome. And also, it's not like...
I've met people who are, like, worried about the erosion of British or English or whatever cultural history and that kind of thing, but that's not advocating white supremacy.
I mean, I've met actual people who think that... I think two or three people in my entire lifetime who have tried to infiltrate groups that are just sort of the dissident right, that go, okay, we've been pushed out by the left, and go, yeah, isn't that right? Now, isn't the solution, you know, all you whites unite? And it's like, no. Everyone in that group's got your...
As soon as you start labelling any argument you don't like as a white supremacist argument, I mean, it's it's saying it's the literally Hitler argument.
Yes. Oh, we'll get onto that later. Don't you worry.
Okay.
So then he goes on to a very Orwellian policy promise as a way of resolving this, right? On Biden's first day in office, he says, I directed my national security and homeland security team to develop a first ever security strategy for countering domestic terrorism. The goal was to improve and enhance our understanding of this growing threat within our country, prevent people from being mobilized to violence, to counter the relentless exploitation of the internet, to recruit and mobilize domestic terrorism. And there's more we have to do together for the whole government approach and the whole nation approach. So that just sounds like fascism. Nothing outside the state, nothing against the state, etc. And you're melding the public and private spheres to make this gigantic state organ all flowing in the same direction. And nothing is outside the purview of state surveillance. That's why today we are launching a new White House initiative on hate-motivated violence. We're going to use every federal resource available to help communities counter hate-fueled violence, build resilience, and foster greater national unity. For example, trainings on identifying, reporting, and combating hate-fueled violence for local law enforcement agencies, workplaces, and houses of worship, making everyone an informant. Partnerships with schools.
What other kind of violence is there apart from hate-fueled?
Yeah, you don't beat someone up because you love them, do you?
No.
But it's strange how, for example, crimes of passion or jealousy aren't listed as hate-fueled violence. It's just the protected classes that we'd like to exalt. Very frustrating. But folks, this is just the beginning. Sounds like a threat. A new bipartisan initiative, Dignity US, will take this nation and this national conversation we launched today on the road across all 50 states and the District of Columbia. A bipartisan presidential center and senior officials from prior Democrat and Republican administrations will all support this effort. We'll get onto that in a moment. We're also about to meet some local heroes as we're honoring the Uniters, 21 fellow Americans, pastors, rabbis, imams, building relationships across faiths, a police officer educating fellow law enforcement officers, a middle school student mobilizing her community, a filmmaker documenting the epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous people, and so many more who are taking a stand. And I'm calling on Congress to get rid of special immunity for social media companies and impose much stronger transparency requirements on all of them. So you see how the narrative converges. You're making everyone in every workplace, every government institution, every school an informant. You're putting specific ideologues there to tell you the correct narrative within your faith, within your ethnic community, which they homogenize you as. And then you're also removing the even veneer of neutrality by Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley are explicitly a Democrat Party apparatus. But now, even if there's dissidence within the company, now you're going to be legally bound to parrot the state-approved narrative. And we seem to have scrapped Nina Jankowicz's Department of Truth, but it's now been just involved into the various disparate apparatus rather than being a central government agency that says, here's the correct narrative. Well, now they're just going to tell each of the arms, the tendrils of this weird octopus that are reaching further into our lives, what to do and how to surveil us. So then we actually have the website up here, dignity.us. If you go to the website yourselves, you can hover over the strange wall of black and white photos from people that are testimonies, and they're just intersectional aggrieved groups. You know, there's obviously legitimate people on there that say, oh, I survived the Holocaust, but then there's also, oh, I got insulted when I was in high school for being brown. And it's just, okay, well, that's an order of magnitude very different. It's co-chaired by Obama and Bush administration staff, again showing the uniparty. There is one Trump administration staff member who was on the coronavirus task force before he resigned. This is Joe Grogan, and he actually stonewalled the Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, and this is according to a Politico report, which will be linked in the show notes but isn't here, who at the time was intent on finally getting rid of Obamacare, but was blocked by not just Republican senators who thought it was a wedge issue, but also Grogan. And Grogan is now on this website. So it's the one of the traitors in the Trump administration, and a bunch of the deep state uniparty staff are part of this weird wall of shame where you can just say, oh, this person did this to me, and also here's the ideologically correct narrative for every institution. So just when Trump banned critical race theory and Biden reversed it, now it seems that it's making it the official doctrine of every single institution, and the state is sponsoring it. Very disturbing stuff. So, just a reminder, the DOJ had spied on parents at school board meetings. This was Merrick Garland, also responsible for signing off on the Trump raid. Attorney General had directed the FBI and the US Attorney's offices to investigate a group of parents, quote, after a group that represents school boards urged the Biden administration to review whether confrontations by outraged parents over COVID restrictions and critical race theory violated the Patriot Act. So again, they're surveilling you, they're setting up an ideologically correct narrative, and if you go against it, you're a, quote, enemy to democracy, and you should be investigated as a domestic terrorist. So parents said, don't mask my kids up in school, it's going to impede their speech and language learning development. Oh, you're put on a no-fly list. Lovely way to treat your fellow Americans, isn't it? Definitely not divisive at all. Remember that COVID started this. So if we go on to the next one. The US Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, fights health misinformation. He gave this really bizarre press conference where he said, health misinformation is false, inaccurate, or misleading information about health, according to the best evidence at the time. And you see the narrative constantly changes. And if the government determines it's true in that moment, then sorry, comrade, you've violated political correctness. There goes your account. And while it often appears innocuous on social media and retail sites or search engines, the truth is that misinformation takes away our freedom to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our loved ones. So unless you parrot our narrative, you don't have any freedom at all. How deeply subversive is that? So then Dr. Murthy wants an all-hands-on-deck approach. You see the mobilization of the entire state again, with health organizations and physicians communicating with their parents to make sure they have the facts, and educational institutions and foundations improving health and information literacy. The Rockefeller Foundation has announced a $13.5 million commitment to counter health misinformation, while the Digital Public Library of America is convening scholars and leaders to combat health misinformation. Again, the private sector that are subsidizing this information, the public sector putting their ideological narrative spinners in place. A major player in the information/disinformation, not misinformation there, very telling, battle are the big tech companies, which are being asked to operate with greater transparency and accountability and take action against misinformation super spreaders. Yeah, good luck getting them to operate with greater transparency, eh? The Surgeon General has asked them in his advisory to step up their efforts to reduce misinformation and take aggressive action, quote, because it's costing people their lives. Now, do you know the difference, definitionally, between disinformation and misinformation?
No.
It's very interesting. Misinformation is accidentally spread stuff. So, like, a post on social media that says, aliens built the pyramids, right? Whether or not they did, we can't firm, of course. But they define that as misinformation. They go, fact-checked. Actually, the Egyptians built the pyramids in this year. Disinformation is intentionally spread propaganda by an enemy state to demoralize the population. But notice how they keep conflating the two there. So they're basically treating Americans who are skeptical of COVID policies, we aren't saying anything about the vaccine on YouTube, of course, as a kind of enemy state within the state that are trying to demoralize the real democratic Americans who did their job and get vaccinated. They're labeling you an enemy of the state if you question their policies. That is just deeply disturbing.
It really is.
So Silicon Valley has now subcontracted this misinformation crusade. There we go. To Silicon Valley, as we see with this Alex Berenson, who's a journalist, who was banned from Twitter over questioning COVID policy, let's say. And he sued Twitter and got his account back. But during the lawsuit and the settlement, he has revealed that he found out that the Biden administration were directly pressuring Twitter themselves to shut down his account. So the White House are censoring American citizens directly in backroom deals. They even actually at one point tried to get them to shut down a Fauci parody account, saying, oh, this isn't one of ours, it has to be gone. That's how sensitive these people are. So Berenson said, after previously hinting the Biden administration may have played a role in deplatforming him from Twitter, he published screenshots of an April 2021 exchange between Twitter employees regarding a meeting it had with White House officials. They had one really tough question about why Alex Berenson hasn't been kicked off the platform, the Twitter employee wrote on the workplace communication platform Slack. In another post, the Twitter employee wrote, they really wanted to know why Berenson... about Berenson, Andy Slavitt suggested they had seen data that showed he was the epicenter of disinformation that radiated outwards towards a persuadable public. Slavitt had served as a White House COVID advisor until he left the Biden administration in June 2021. So this is the guy who got Berenson taken down. Berenson confirmed with Fox News Digital that he had obtained the Slack communications as part of his settled lawsuit against Twitter, but he couldn't elaborate but he did add, I hope and expect to have more information to report soon. So then he went on Joe Rogan Experience and he said, I had a whistleblower inside Twitter saying they wanted to actually debate about COVID policy within the company, but were immediately shut down. And it's because of the pressure exerted on them by the Biden administration, for them within the White House, that they're just kicking Americans off of the platform.
Yeah, we're going to come to a story about PayPal in a bit, but we know that the same thing is going on there. The government is using big tech as a tool. And it is very concerning.
Well, if they have a monopoly on the public square, then...
And these big tech, whether it agrees with the government line or not, you know, whether it's YouTube or Twitter or PayPal or Facebook, whatever it is going to toe the line in order to survive.
Absolutely.
It's a business.
Yeah. You have a financial incentive there to just keep your head down.
Yeah.
But
especially now they've got the monopoly on their little bits of the internet.
As soon as we see Jack Dorsey ducking out from being Twitter CEO, for example, he comes out and said, yeah, there was pressure on me to censor the Hunter Biden laptop story. Yes, we were wrong to do this, that, and the other. There was a time even when Vijaya Gadd and Jack Dorsey went on Joe Rogan with Tim Pool. I don't know if you've seen the episode.
I haven't.
But it was in 2018 or 2019, well before COVID, and they said, we won't censor vaccine misinformation because anti-vaxxers are entitled to their wrong views. Look what happened there. It became suddenly very expedient to censor people who were critical of COVID policy. Again.
I'm really surprised that this is still going on now. Because in the UK, I mean, COVID's not a thing anymore.
No. No, we were one of the flagship countries to decommission our COVID policies and live freely, even though it's very interesting that...
It happened accidentally.
Yes, because of Steve,
yeah.
And then it was about a couple of days
before... It happened before, for the wrong reasons.
Well, also, it happened a couple of days before the Ukraine invasion was announced. But
no, it goes back to December, I think, of last year when Boris was about to lock us down again.
Yes.
And Steve Baker and various others on the back benches said, rebelled. If you lock us down, we are vote of no confidence. And so we changed tack. And then over the next couple of months, our COVID rates were no different from everywhere that locked down on the continent. And so it just made the whole thing look farcical.
But they did bring they were originally going to have the restrictions delayed, repealing them until, I believe it was June, and they brought them back to about April. And that was a couple of days after they had the Ukraine war briefing.
So yeah. Putin ended COVID.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's not give
but
the man
I was going
too much
to
credit,
France in March skiing, and you had to have to go and sit in an outside restaurant. You had to have your vaccine thingy. And the police were giving people fines for not wearing masks on the chairlifts.
Yeah, they were throwing tear gas in open-air cafes because people weren't moving.
I mean, please.
It's genuinely contemptible. But if you questioned any of that and you were an American, the White House were rifling through your tweets. They were getting you kicked off platforms. And if we go to a New York Post article, if you questioned the American election, for example, the most safe and secure election in history, then the FBI were going through your private messages.
Okay.
Gosh. Yes, on
Facebook. My mum lives in the States, and she's still wearing masks and stuff.
Oh, she bought the...
She feels vulnerable. She got pretty bad long COVID.
Right.
So she's scared of it.
There was a study that came out fairly recently, I believe even CNN reported on it, that the symptoms of self-perceived long COVID are increased if you have a pre-existing history of anxiety and depression. So we, of course, cannot claim it is hypochondria, but CNN appeared to be spreading health misinformation.
Hypochondria is a bit of an extreme term, but there's definitely a psychosomatic effect.
Sadly so. So if we look at the New York Post's special report, this obviously makes sense when Mark Zuckerberg told Joe Rogan that the FBI had pressured, he went very willingly, to censor the Hunter Biden laptop story. But the New York Post says Facebook had spied on the private messages of Americans who had questioned the 2020 election. Facebook has been spying on the messages and data of American users and reporting them to the FBI if they expressed anti-government or anti-authority sentiments or questioned the 2020 election, according to sources within the Department of Justice itself. Under the FBI collaboration, somebody at Facebook red-flagged supposedly subversive private messages, over the past 19 months and submitted them in redacted form to the Domestic Terrorism Operational Unit at the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., without a subpoena. So it was completely below board, not at all legally justified. It was done outside the legal process and without probable cause, said one of the sources, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Facebook provides the FBI with private conversations, which are protected by the First Amendment without any subpoena. The FBI, however, found no actionable criminal activity from any of the messages they reviewed. So you must have think they must have poured through millions, and zero Americans could have been prosecuted by it. The Facebook users whose private communications Facebook had red flagged as domestic terrorism for the FBI were, quote, all conservative right-wing individuals. They were gun-toting, red-blooded Americans, angry after the election, and shooting off their mouths and talking about staging protests. There was nothing criminal, nothing about violence, nothing about massacres or assassinating anyone. As soon as a subpoena was requested within an hour, Facebook sent back gigabytes of data and photos. It was ready to go. They were just waiting for that legal process so they could send it. So then Facebook tried to deny this and also affirmed it. So they contradicted themselves within two contrasting statements sent about an hour apart. So Erica Sakin, a spokesperson at Facebook's parent company Meta, I hate that name, claimed Facebook's interactions with the FBI were designed to, quote, protect people from harm. In her second, updated statement, Sakin altered her language to say the claims are wrong and not false. So it's actually in reverse order. Originally he said it's a good thing, and then they said we aren't doing it. When normally it's we're not doing this, and then 6 months down the line, oh, but we did it, but it was for a good thing. It was to protect your health, to protect the NHS. So it's strange that Facebook haven't quite caught up on the leftist train of narratives yet. Sakin, funnily enough, is a DC-based crisis response expert who previously worked for Planned Parenthood and Obama for America, and now leads Facebook's communications on counterterrorism and dangerous organizations and individuals. So do we think that there might be a little bit of bias at work there in who they're trawling through the messages of at all? Yeah. So we shouldn't underestimate the impacts of this. We go on to the next. We're not going to read through this, but of course everyone's seen this famous one, the confessional by Time magazine, the secret history of the shadow campaign that saved the 2020 election, where they literally use the word cabal to describe Silicon Valley NGOs and politicians working together to ensure that Donald Trump did not storm into the White House and have another terrible term. And it was definitely all above board, of course. It was the most safe and secure election in American history. If we'd like to go on to what they hid, if you sign up to lotuseasers.com, you'll be able to watch Josh and Carl go through the despicable debauched degeneracy of Hunter Biden. We subjected Josh to not only Hunter Biden's laptop, but the iCloud leaks. And so he went through all of the alleged crimes and things caught on video by Biden's least favorite son. And dear God, if this would have come out before the election, of course, you see some swing voters that said, oh, I wouldn't have voted for that. Well, the consequences of suppressing this information and persecuting Americans who dissent is that someone gets into the White House without voters being fully informed as to the business dealings and degenerate activities of his family. And I don't understand how you can have an informed democracy with that kind of conduct, of course. But, as you preambled, could be worse because Trump is literally Hitler. Yeah. The Bad Orange Man played a horrible song at his rally, and that's right, he's way worse. Way, way worse. While speaking in Youngstown in support of J.D. Vance, whom he has endorsed in Ohio's Republican nominee for Senate race, Mr. Trump delivered a dark address about the decline of America over music that was all but identical to a song called WWG1WGA, an abbreviation for the QAnon slogan, Where We Go One, We Go All. As Mr. Trump spoke, scores of people in the crowd raised fingers in the air in an apparent reference to the one in which they thought was the song's title. It was the first time in memory that some Trump aides had seen such a display that occurred at one of his rallies. Mr. Trump's aide said the song played at the rally was called Mirrors, and it was selected for use in the video that Mr. Trump played at the conservative meeting CPAC and posted on a social media site, Truth Social. But it sounds strikingly similar to the QAnon theme song. Again, this is just BlueAnon. This is just Democrat conspiracy mongering. I don't think an entire crowd of Trump's supporters believe that there's someone on 4chan posting leaks from inside the administration that Trump is suddenly going to become secretly president tomorrow. He's going to storm back into the White House. I don't think everyone raising their finger as number one is in cahoots with the QAnon conspiracy theory. There's like two people that actually believe it online, maybe. But subsequently, Nazi Germany trended on Twitter, because of course it did. Yep, great. Also trending in the United Kingdom. Look, we report on American politics here because we want our former colony, don't get upset viewers, to have the best government possible, especially because when America catches a cold, you know, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. That's the old saying. But why is Trump living rent-free in random UK Twitter leftist activists' heads? Literally, people are comparing it to the 1930s Germany salute. Bit delusional. But if we come on to the last one, we've got one white pill. Thought we'd end on a happy note, shall we? Alex Berenson. Boom, I say again, boom. The Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals just said that Twitter and other social media platforms don't have an unlimited right to discriminate against speech. So, turns out the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, if you scroll down just slightly, John, so I can read the press release. The First Amendment protects speech. It generally prevents the government from interfering with people's speech or forcing them to speak. The platforms argue that because they host and transmit speech, the First Amendment also gives them an unqualified license to invalidate the laws that hinder them from censoring speech they don't like. And they say that license entitles them to pre-enforcement facule relief against HB20. We reject the platform's attempt to extract a freewheeling censorship right from the Constitution's free speech guarantee. The platforms are not newspapers. Their censorship is not speech. They are not entitled to pre-enforcement facule relief. And HB20 is constitutional because it neither compels nor obstructs the platform's own speech in any way. The district court erred in concluding otherwise and abused its discretion by issuing a preliminary injunction. The preliminary injunction is vacated and this case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. This opens the door to Berenson uncovering a bunch of censorship by Silicon Valley over the course of the pandemic. And we will hopefully see the collusion between the Biden White House and Silicon Valley to enact a sort of Patriot Act 2.0 on law-abiding Americans that just have questions about some of the policies they dislike. And not about you, but I'm quite happy at that prospect.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with this, and then they'll raise an inquiry. Mm. There'll be an inquiry, and that'll take 5 years, and then it'll be even longer than the Chilcot report, and so on and so forth. And the perpetrators, you know, they won't be taken to account. There might be a couple. I mean, America does this stuff better than we do, but yeah, I'd much rather it happened before the event than after.
So did
but
I.
But it's still good.
Yes, let's hope that's Trump's Schedule F, where he's going to remove plenty of deep state operatives who don't get their money's worth, goes ahead, and we get some people to actually prosecute this on principle, and we see Silicon Valley become the speech utilities and platforms rather than the censorious publishers that they have appointed themselves as. And if we can get the government narrative, the current thing, out of our ability to speak freely as is our right, then, well, that'd make for a much better democracy over in the US, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So am I taking over now?
Go for it. Your
okay,
segment.
Now,
take the
so
reins.
This is my segment. And now, am I doing this to you or am I doing it down the camera? Just as
it's up to you, however you would like to deliver.
Okay, well, I'll do a little bit of both. So this is a story of, we all know the journalist Toby Young. He's associate editor of The Spectator. And I've known him quite a long time. And he's... ever since I've known him, and probably before, he's always been trying to set up organisations that improve people's lives. And so, for example, he was very disappointed with the lowering of standards in schools, and so he helped found the first free school in West London. And in 2020, he set up the Free Speech Union, which was to help defend people threatened with cancellation.
I've actually been helped by that, funnily enough.
And I've had a long conversation about an incident that happened to me. And his website, the Daily Skeptic, is a news and commentary website born out of all the misinformation,
yes,
and disinformation and censorship, especially by big tech, that emerged during COVID. But now, if you talk to Toby, he's actually quite he's just like a sort of bog standard centre-right old school conservative. He thinks we should have state education. He thinks we should have the NHS. He's not like a rabid libertarian like
you
yours truly. But I guess because he's an intellectual force, or for whatever reason, he is absolutely loathed by his ideological enemies. I mean, really despised. And they work tirelessly to bring him down. And time and time again, he lost something like 5 jobs in 2016 because of what he calls offence archaeologists, yep, digging up stuff that he'd said, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, quoting it out of context and then being offended. So that's Toby. And last week, PayPal, he got an email out of the blue from PayPal, and it closed his personal account for breaching its acceptable use policy. And then barely a few minutes later, he got an email that PayPal had closed down the account of the Daily Skeptic, the news and commentary website. And then a few minutes after that, it closed down the accounts for the Free Speech Union. Now, this is no small disruption because, you know, if you think how many hours and days and months and years it takes to build up a following and build up a subscriber base. And I think something like a quarter of the Daily Skeptic's revenue comes via PayPal. And according to Young, a third of the Free Speech's union's members pay their dues via PayPal. And now, I'm going to quote Young now. He said, "I did some Googling and I discovered that numerous organizations and individuals with dissident political views have had their accounts closed down by PayPal recently, particularly over 3 issues you're not allowed to be skeptical about: the lockdown policy and other COVID restrictions, the mRNA vaccines, and the climate emergency. The Daily Skeptic frequently publishes issues on these subjects, and the Free Speech Union may have fallen foul of another taboo, which is defending people who've got into trouble with HR departments for expressing their gender-critical views. Now, there are other, we learned today that there's a parent group called Us For Them, which campaigned to keep schools open during the pandemic.
Good on
them. They've been shut down as well. And now, how is PayPal able to do this without warning? Because it can. Because it's a private company, it does what it like. If it wants to shut down your account, it can. Did the same to WikiLeaks in 2010. I mean, that was, must have been under enormous pressure from the United States government to close it down, because WikiLeaks was a huge threat, all the information it was disclosing. And unfortunately, this always makes me laugh, this massively backfired, because people then started donating to WikiLeaks using Bitcoin. Mm. And because of the enormous appreciation in Bitcoin that happened since 2010, it's turned WikiLeaks into one of the most richest organizations there is, assuming they kept some of their Bitcoins, which I gather they have. Now, the PayPal founder, Peter Thiel, massive libertarian, wrote one of the great essays about libertarianisms in 2008. I quote it all the time, and I've now forgotten the title. And he's probably on the same philosophical side of the argument as Toby Young is.
I have some severe reservations about him.
Maybe you do. First and foremost, though, he is a businessman. And PayPal will do whatever is asked of it in order to survive. And particularly when it started out, it was seen as a huge money laundering tool, cross-national payments. And in order to survive as a business, it had to demonstrate that it would not be a vehicle for money laundering and criminal activity, any kind of illicit activity. And so now PayPal is really, really stringent in who you can pay money to, when you're trying to withdraw money to. Like, for example, if I get paid in US dollars and I keep the US dollars in my PayPal account and I want to withdraw the US dollars and not pay PayPal Forex charges.
Yeah.
So say I wanted to withdraw it to my Revolut account, which I can keep US dollars in, I can't do that with PayPal. I can only withdraw the money in the currency of where I'm from. And so that means I've got to pay PayPal's ludicrous Forex charges.
I've fallen afoul of that before.
Anyway, Thiel's no longer PayPal's CEO. And like so much of big tech, what started out one way as censorship-free, free speech, all that, by its founders, it's just gone somewhere else. And this is evidenced by all the censorship that goes on. And it seems that, you know, Dellingpole's forever saying this, James Dellingpole, that the middle and upper management of big tech has been infected by people on the other side of the culture war to where we are. Let's just put it that way. So that's what's happened. Now, there's a bigger theme at play here. And this is just an example of something much bigger. And it's deeply concerning. And that is, I've in everything, practically every article I've ever written, every book I've ever written, my core argument has always been, we need to separate money and state.
Yep.
At the moment, money is an issuance of the state. And worse than that, it has become a tool of government. So whether it's suppressing interest rates to boost the housing market and maintain popularity, printing money to bail out banks, or indeed the entire economy during COVID, or freezing the accounts of political enemies, the truckers in Canada, or Russia, the entire of Russia, finance is being weaponized.
Yes.
And governments weaponize money. Like, they'll always go to collect taxes that are easy to collect, and taxes that are hard to collect, they tend not to pursue. That's why
you can see that with the new IRS agents. Of where did you see their training exercise by any chance?
No.
So they've just hired 87,000 IRS agents. They've armed them to the teeth. The training exercise wasn't breaking down Jeff Bezos's door, for example. It was breaking down the door of a small business owner who had forgotten to claim a lawnmower on his tax receipt, and they were arresting him for that.
You see that like mad in HMRC here as well. They'll go for the small business and they'll leave big tech globalized, whatever.
Yeah, alone. That's why there's so few police officers on the streets, but the parking attendants are plenty. They're three to the road.
Yeah, and it's also a lot easier to police Twitter than it is knife crime.
Yes.
But anyway, and it's one reason income tax is so high. Income tax is an easy tax collect. You go to the employer. If you do not collect this tax for us, you go to jail. So the employer does the job for them. Now, governments weaponize money because it's an easy tool for them to get the results they want. It's a lot easier to sanction Russia and freeze its accounts and confiscate its money than it is to go to war with Russia. It's a lot easier to cut off the truckers' funding than it is to confront them. It's a lot easier and quicker to print the money you need to bail out the banking system than it is to collect that money in taxes. If it had to collect that money in advance in taxes, there would be no QE.
Or just spend responsibly in the first place.
Well, that was the... And in another age, that's what rulers would have had to do. If they wanted to spend money, they had to collect it in taxes. It's a lot easier to suppress interest rates and collect the inflation tax than it is to impose direct taxes or rein in spending. Inflation tax is a stealth tax. It's Milton Friedman used to call it taxation without legislation. Now, the irony of such actions is that, as with WikiLeaks, they will accelerate the adoption of censor-free non-state alternatives, of which Bitcoin is the most obvious example. Yep. The US, by confiscating Russian assets and freezing it out of the banking system, is going to accelerate the development of a non-US international system of money for the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, the SCO, which is basically every country from west of Japan to east of Ukraine. Yep. You know, all the stands and all that. And there's going to be... It's going to accelerate the adoption of a challenger to the US dollar.
Along the digital Silk Road that they've built up with their Belt and Road Initiative.
And there's an actual Silk Road that they've built up, and there are train lines, they're all building and all the rest.
It's 140 countries at this point. It's insane.
It's enormous. Territorially, I think it's like 40%, it's 30% of world GDP and 40% of world landmass or something like that. I can't remember the exact numbers. Now, so this weaponization of money, in the long term, it may backfire, but in the short term, it works, and government thinks in the short term. And it shuts off funding taps and it creates considerable hardship and inconvenience. Now, I use PayPal all the time. It's convenient. I use it as a buyer, as I use it as a seller, but I should really switch to another payment provider.
The Dan Bongino has launched one, which Tim Pool's show is using the infrastructure of. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but I'm sure a viewer will put it in.
I'm sure, and Stripe's really good. That none of the others are as censorious as PayPal. But if they're pressured, you can be sure they will be, because they will need to survive as a business. And now what gets me really concerned is, as we're now moving towards central bank digital currency, CBDCs, this weaponization of money is going to get a lot more intense. Now, I'm just going to change tack slightly. I've still got another 5 minutes or so.
That's fine. Yeah, of course you do.
So when one body in a society has the power to print money, to create money at no cost to itself, it is inevitable that that body will have disproportionate power within the society. So you and I, we can't create money. We have to work and expend energy to get money. A government can just print it. Now, if you are looking for one explanation as to how it is the state in the West has grown so enormous, it's something like 50% of GDP now, it's certainly 50% of tax revenue by the time you factor in inflation. At the turn of the 20th century, it was just 10%. If you're looking for one reason, it is our system of fiat money. It is the zero patient, patient zero. Money is the blood of an economy. If you want to understand the inequality gap, why young people can't afford a house, all of that, look no further than our system of money. Why Western families are so small. The primary reason given is always we would have a bigger family if we could afford it.
Yep.
But most can't, because they've got this enormous cost of government in their lives. That's only the very bottom. Of course you are. You can't afford a house. You can't start a fat. How old are you?
23. Yeah.
I thought, because so well read, I thought you were about 10 years older. But anyway, the only people who can afford to have big subsidies are either those in welfare at the very bottom or the very rich. 90% in the middle can't. And so instead of having big families, we import our youth from abroad.
Yes.
And we import a load of other problems with them. And then we can't understand why British values are being eroded and disappearing.
Yeah, especially with a resentful underclass whose only attachment to the country is an economic one.
There you go. And so it all comes back to our system of money. And, you know, in 1971, that was the big turning point because that was when America came off the gold standard. You know, you could afford a house for three times your earnings. Yep. You just can't now.
It's like The Simpsons. Homer Simpson is a working class guy. He doesn't do a particularly technical job at the nuclear power plant, but he has a very large detached house to support two pets and three kids on a single income. And that was expected. And then now...
It's normal. Houses don't cost a lot of money to build. Mm. And we all think it's because we don't build enough. It's not. It's if you measure inflation by money supply growth rather than by the cost of a few consumer goods, the housing has gone up by as much as the money supply has increased.
Yeah, it's now and it's 10 because times the average income.
You print and you create money, and most of it, because debt is how you create money and mortgages is how most debt is created, and it all goes into real estate. Now, of course, some states are more benign than others, and our 21st century social democracies, for all their woeful waste, are preferable to many of the governing systems elsewhere in the world, in other more tyrannical corners. But the damage done has still been enormous, and we are careering towards a far more nefarious destination. And that is why I am such, and have always been such, a proponent of non-state money, gold and Bitcoin. And it's also why the prospect of central bank digital currencies, which, by the way, I think are inevitable,
yep,
because technology is destiny. They fill me with such bread, because programmable money, we're already in the weaponization of finance, but programmable money is just going to give governments even more control and influence. Now, your every transaction can be monitored, and that's like Orwellian surveillance states. Certain transactions can be outlawed. If you're not a government-approved buyer or a seller, then you can't transact with that person. Taxes and fines can just be removed from your account without your approval. And you know what it's like when a utility company takes a bill from you and they take it out wrong and then you try and get the money back. It's a nightmare. It takes months. Imagine trying to get it back from the government. And they're going to give huge scope to behavioral economists who all share that top-down status, we know better than you worldview. The ministries of nudges around the world, you're going to be goaded into all sorts of decisions you might not otherwise have made.
Sage has just set up a climate change advisory policy group. So they've moved on from pandemics now to there.
Well, this is really interesting because social credit systems are coming.
Yes.
And are you a good citizen? Then you get the favorable rate of interest. Yes. You get the good loan deal. You get the incentives. Do you articulate wrong thought on the internet? Are you cynical about this climate emergency narrative? Did you have the vaccine? You know, like we asked you to. And if the answer to any of these questions is no, and it will no, because it's all going to be in your phone somewhere, you will get less favorable rates and you will become a second-class citizen. If you are a naughty boy, your account might be frozen altogether,
yeah,
or suspended for a period, the same way you get suspended on Twitter or something if you utter wrong thing. And we are going to a very, very dangerous place. And, you know, Bitcoin was originally built in reaction to all the money printing that went on in 2008 to bail out the banks. The headline in the very first block in the blockchain, the Genesis block, was "Chancellor on brink of second bailout for the banks." It was a reference to the Times headline of that day. And here is a money system that nobody, whether government or hacker or whatever, you cannot print it, you cannot debase it. The rules are set in code. The inflation rate is transparent. It's clearly laid out. It's set in the code. And the system, rather than rely on trust, whether it's in a bank or a central bank or a government or a payment provider, it's based on mathematical proof and computer power, backed up by computer power. So it is apolitical money. It is censorship-resistant money. It is trustless. You don't need to trust in anyone. It is hard money. And this PayPal story, the no platforming of Toby Young, is a very good example of why we need Bitcoin. Bitcoin, the standard expression is Bitcoin fixes this, and it really does fix it. And this is the world to which we're heading that I've just described. And there's a very strong use case for Bitcoin. So I urge everyone to own some. You don't have to own a lot. You don't have to risk a lot of money, but familiarize yourself with the tech, get your Bitcoin wallet, be able to transact in non-government monies, because it is one of the few things. It's one of like the few technical areas that can save us from all of this. And it's a largely unregulated space because nobody knows how to regulate what hasn't been invented yet. It's full of invention. It's full of opportunity. And if you want to get really anti-state, look at some of the privacy currencies, Monero, Zcash, Decred, there are others. But I'd be really careful with these because you're on dodgy ground and they could make them illegal at any time. And then just by holding any of these currencies, you're guilty of some kind of crime. And I also find that in terms of price appreciation, the privacy currencies are always a bit of a disappointment. But yeah, I mean, I think I've made my point. We are going to a dangerous place. And it is very worrying, but to a degree, Bitcoin fixes this.
I would urge anyone who would like some more information on Peter Thiel and some of the Silicon Valley CEOs, for example, to check out a deep think on the website called The Real Vampires of Silicon Valley. I won't spoil that. There's also an audio track. And for more information on central bank digital currencies, I would urge people to go and look at my deep think called The WEF's ESGs are the Mark of the Beast. Both of those are very informative. I do have a question quickly for you. I was told recently that Ethereum, which I own a little bit in, has been taken off of proof of stake. And it looks like it's going to be a technology co-opted because unlike Bitcoin, it is manipulable and it can be printed infinitely.
That's absolutely right. It's switched from proof of work to proof of stake.
Yeah.
And this is a tactical decision of its founder, Vitalik.
Difficult name.
What's his second name? I can't remember his second name. Excuse the bad language there. Vitalik Buterin. And he's a massive libertarian, by the way, and he subscribes to that Peter Thiel view that the only space you can't achieve political change through politics. You have to achieve it through new frontiers and new tech and so on. And him and his advisors, they've decided to go to proof of stake. Now, I'm a big believer in proof of work, but proof of work, like the founder of Ripple, or one of the founders of Ripple, has just given $5 million to Greenpeace to campaign against Bitcoin's proof of work system. Right. So over the next few months, it's already starting. You're going to see all this environmental...
Bitcoin is bad for the planet narrative.
Bitcoin is bad for the planet. Now, actually, what Bitcoin does, there's this idea that if you consume a lot of energy, it is bad. It's not that simple. Human beings consume more energy the more we evolve. And we get better at consuming energy and we consume it more cleanly. Just because you consume a lot of energy doesn't mean you're environmentally unfriendly. And what Bitcoin does is it consumes energy in the most effective way. So Bitcoin mining gravitates to parts of the world where energy is not, it's just sitting there unconsumed and it would otherwise be wasted. So it's in fact, for example, they take, when they flare the US, gas things in the oil fields, Bitcoin mining is taking that energy instead. And so it's in fact making more efficient use of energy. And I think something like 70% of Bitcoin energy mining is now renewable. So it makes use of hydroelectricity and all the rest of it. Now, but nevertheless, the argument is embedded in people's heads. Proof of work equals lots of energy consumption equals bad for the planet. And so I mean, there's already noises about banning Bitcoin mining in North America. And of course, Biden hates it. Of course, they hate it because it's a challenge. Even Trump was anti-Bitcoin. But that Ethereum has now gone proof of stake, which centralizes it. And when you centralize something, and I think already the two main miners in the proof of stake are like Coinbase, which is the big wallet provider, and another one.
Which is partnered with the WEF, funnily enough.
Okay. So, you know, it is concerning Ethereum, but Buterin is a genius. I mean, I've got some Ethereum and there are lots of apps built on top of it. And, you know, that's the thing. It's still experimental. Yeah. So we don't know how it's going to end up. But Buterin knows, you think Buterin knows what he's doing. The Bitcoin maximalists will be critical, but there are plenty of Ethereum maximalists that say this is the way to go. So I'm actually going to hedge my bets and say I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I really appreciate that. And as we said, there is a deep think mentioned. So thank you very much to John for pulling that up. So to our final segment, I suppose. Did you know that British soaps are brainwashing you? Well, probably not you if you're watching this podcast, because you can't be bothered to tune into terrestrial television, and very smart of you. The adverts are nauseating. They don't look like the world on your doorstep, let's put it that way. And also, these kinds of things are written pretty poorly, but they might be indoctrinating your grandmother, your mother, your aunt. I know my mum watches at least 3 out of 4 of the soaps we're going to mention here every night and makes a little ritual of it. Hi, Mum. You're right there. However, it's quite interesting if you don't watch these things. I watch them in passing as I go into the kitchen for occasion when I stay there. It's funny how you might not notice that they're using this as a Trojan horse for ideological narratives. They're really pushing the current thing through what should be primetime entertainment. So I thought we'd go through some of the clips and look at what we might be missing as comedians yourself, political commentators myself, perennially on the internet and in alternative spheres, that the mainstream people who aren't always tuning into the podcast may be being exposed to very much to their own detriment. I'd like to point out first that even though I had this segment in mind for a little while, Paul Joseph Watson, friend of the show from Cole, did make a video on this fairly recently. We're not going to play any of it, but of course, credit to Paul. But I've got a few more clips that we're going to have to be subjected to and stories that he didn't cover in there. And so it makes it an incredibly valuable little segment, I suppose. So first, over to the Yorkshire
Dales.
Can
I just say, they've always been propaganda, haven't they? I mean, wasn't the Archers originally there to disseminate information to farmers? Wasn't that the original purpose of the...
Yeah, sure.
Which is inherently propagandistic.
No, specifically about that, but we're talking about, I suppose, the message specifically that they're putting forward in the current year, which is racially segregating activism and calling everyone a conspiracy theorist which questions government narratives.
Okay.
Yes. So I'm going to show you some clips that you might be utterly blinded by. So I thought I'd subject you to this for a bit of fun. So firstly, we're going to something that is quite innocuous. Emmerdale's actor James Moore, and why he's proud to be disabled and on screen. He recently won a National Television Award, and he said that his disability doesn't stop him from being an actor. He said, despite disabilities featuring much more heavily on our screens, there is still a long way to go. And so, even though well done to this fella for doing very well and overcoming his disability and becoming a very successful actor, you can see how the presupposition is we have to do more for X group. Rather than telling an authentic story, we have to have characters now centered around which box they tick. And he might be a perfectly nice fella, but I know, for example, EastEnders has done something around the same time with a deaf character. You're seeing increasingly storylines are written around who we should represent and what we should be telling you, how we should be reaching through the screen and shaking our viewers with the message, rather than, is this a compelling story? I know saying compelling story for soaps when it's either a death or a pregnancy endlessly is always, or an extramarital affair is maybe a bit of a fallacy to appeal to, but it's definitely outside the norm of, I don't know, Barbara Windsor smacking Pat Butcher around the face and throwing her earrings off. It's less get out of my pub and more, you know, get on board with my particular politics. So Emmerdale has, after 2020, introduced a black family as part of its BLM drive, because its black characters are now just political pawns, it seems. Emmerdale is bringing a new black family to, quote, the heart of the village, the soap announced tonight when writing this article 2 years ago. ITV explains that...
It's set in Cumbria, Emmerdale, isn't it?
I think it's the Yorkshire Dales.
Okay.
Yes.
Of course it would be, yeah.
Yes. ITV explained that its changes were brought in by the broadcaster in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement last summer and all of the peaceful protests that brought. ITV's continuing drama boss John Winston said the Black Lives Matter movement rightly gave us an impetus to many great initiatives on screen and off screen for us. Off-screen meaning activism. For us, a key part of that is increasing the number of BAME writers and directors, because for some reason anyone who isn't white is just part of a big ethnic block and you're all the same, according to these producers, which I don't think so, obviously. The writers and directors we employ, as they are key to the creative powerhouse behind the shows. ITV has been running a campaign called Black Voices, capital B Black, by the way, airing short films where people talk about the experiences of racism and talk about their hopes for the future. Have you noticed this increasing capital B black in articles and things like that?
I haven't, but I'm noticing it now.
Yeah, so what it is, it's actually an effort by the critical race theorists who want to posit black people within quote-unquote white societies, so that's England, America, Europe, as a nation within a nation, as a homogenous group, no matter whether you're Ghanaian and Nigerian or from the West Indies or Haiti. it means that you're somehow all bound together because you have melanin and because you don't look like what they believe is the dominant group in society that's totally unaccepting.
It annoys me because, like, people would say my wife, who I'm no longer with, but they would say she was black.
Right.
But she wasn't. She was mixed race. Mm. People say Obama was black.
Yes.
And to me, he wasn't. He was mixed race. Mm. And, you know, he was half white, half black. And as was my, and so my kids, my eldest two kids are a quarter.
Yeah.
So they're technically mixed race. And I just think to describe anyone who's got any black in them as black.
Yeah. Is as racist as the one that
Obama
the Democrats
was as white
used.
As he was black.
Yes. Yeah. But it's also they're capitalizing off of that inaccurate classification.
It's
to
all this
raise
identity.
Resentment and involuntarily politicize your identity. And
I'd like to have a conversation with a black person about that because I'd be interested to know what I've got wrong. Well, what I've got right. Or
Zuby was in yesterday and he and Carl was going through his tweets as he went around traveling.
Carl's
the world.
Mixed race.
Yeah, technically, yeah. And Zuby just said, well, I don't feel represented by a woman by the colour of her skin. Instead, I feel represented more by the people I associate with in this office because we share politics, we share a worldview, we share interests like going to the gym and improving ourselves. But I don't feel represented by, for example, Patrice Cullors, who's the open Marxist who runs Black Lives Matter, who steals money from grieving families. I don't feel represented by someone who's evil just because we share a skin colour. But unfortunately, people that write shows like Emmerdale think that that's the same thing, and that's utterly cruel.
Mm.
It's also hilarious because one of the sons that's been introducing this black family in Emmerdale is gay man. And it would be very interesting to ask the heavily Christian Nigerian immigrants as to what they think of homosexuality because I don't think you'll get a homogenous opinion.
Listen to some Caribbean music, what they've got to say about homosexuality as
Yes, it's not remarkably tolerant. speaking of terrible race politics and homogeneity, let's go on to Hollyoaks briefly. It's Hollyoaks, but now with an all-black cast. Yeah, so Channel 4 will air the UK's first continuing drama to be made with an all-black cast and written and directed by black talent as part of the broadcaster's Capital B Black to Front diversity initiative. Shooting is underway on the hour-long special episode of Hollyoaks, starring, written and directed by black British
What's
talent.
What's Hollyoaks about?
Hollyoaks is one of the younger soaps, so it's less about families, it's more about young people. I don't know exactly where it's set, actually.
Wasn't it set in Liverpool?
I don't think it's set in Liverpool, but I could be wrong. It's the only one that my mum doesn't watch, and so I'm not as familiar with it. Actually, my uncle used to watch it.
I'm pretty ignorant about soaps.
I don't blame you. Yeah, most terrestrial TV is unwatchable at the moment.
Just go up a little bit. I want to see the name of that actor on the left.
It's Richard Blackwood.
Oh, of course it is.
Yes, yeah. I've watched a pantomime with him in Catford, actually, years ago, which is quite funny seeing him there. The soap launched an investigation last year after a number of black cast members.
He could have been massive, Richard Blackwood. He was on when he was doing his MTV show. There was a real kind of freshness about him, and he was like,
"That's what someone else said."
He was really going to be a big star, and I don't know.
Instead, now his career has been co-opted into a political movement to berate viewers with white guilt.
Yeah.
So apparently, the reason they did this is because they had a racism allegation on set. So last year, Hollyoaks launched an investigation after the black actor Rachel Adedeji, I hope I got that right, tweeted several claims about her experiences of racism on the set. Adedeji claimed that senior producer referred to black cast members using a racial slur, doesn't list what that one is, so obviously that's just an allegation, and that black female actors were, quote, forced to drastically change their hair because otherwise viewers would not be able to tell them apart. If that was said, obviously that's ridiculously racist, but that then doesn't mean that you make an all-black episode, which buys into the idea that, oh yeah, blacks are all the same, so we might as well just have them represented by one big group. You don't end racism with more racism. But it's interesting, actually, because this has been spurred on by Channel 4 working with the Sir Lenny Henry Centre for Media Diversity on the Black to Front initiative. And Sir Lenny Henry, of course, has been recently in headlines for helping to ruin the Rings of Power by saying that it's our time now about being black.
Lenny
and
Henry,
Tolkien.
The entertainment industry has been so kind to Lenny Henry.
Yes.
And he just never stops moaning.
No, he never stops moaning about apparently Glastonbury's too white.
Just practice some gratitude.
Yes, that is actually the perfect takeaway from this. Please practice some gratitude. So, let's go on to EastEnders, because of course they're doing something similar. EastEnders unveils timely mural of black woman, a giant judgmental mural of a black woman opposite the Queen Vic, staring at it, because apparently the Queen Vic pub is an icon of white supremacy. EastEnders viewers will spot a new face when the BBC soap returns, and this was in 2020, painted on a wall opposite the Queen Vic pub. The mural of a black woman, just a random black woman, not even necessarily a person that's specific to EastEnders, was painted by Nottingham-born, not an EastEnder, visual artist Dreff, and measuring 5 meters by 2 meters in size. It will be a permanent backdrop to storylines. Dreff, real name Nikaye Dezane, hope I got that right, called having his work become a fixture on the show a really exciting opportunity. I'm so pleased that EastEnders has found a way to reflect the modern day UK in a time when so many of us are finding ways to voice anti-racism. Anti-racism is something that the cast, crew and producers care passionately about at EastEnders. Are you familiar with this term anti-racism? Like what it actually means?
No.
Okay, so for those who have come across this term in daily life but aren't sure, anti-racism is actually invented by Ibrahim X. Kendi. He's an academic who wrote the book How to Be an Anti-Racist, and he also wrote a government white paper to give as a policy to the Democrats, which said we should appoint a citizens' assembly of black-only academics, of course including himself, that should oversee every policy the US government puts out, and if it doesn't result in equity between racial groups, so that's, for those who don't know, equal outcomes between groups, even though, as we've already said, different ethnic groups, different histories, different people and the diverse opinions make up those ethnic groups, you're not going to get the same outcome across them. Unless those policies produce the same outcomes for white and black, we can't have the policy. So you can't elect this group, and he's giving himself a job. So it's literally a dictatorship of the proletariat by race to ensure equal material outcomes. So it's race-based communism, smuggled in with a euphemistic phrase, which of course we would all agree with being anti-racist, because I don't think much about skin colour in my daily life, and I'm not going to discriminate against a person on those grounds. But apparently, you do with this. And his exact quote was actually, we need present discrimination to remedy past discrimination. So he thinks, discriminate against white people in the present because some white people discriminate against some black people in the past. So it's just an openly racist doctrine. But they're saying EastEnders has always stood for this. Mm. Astounding. They've also introduced their first drag character. Look at this stunning and bravery, shall we? If we scroll down to the image, please, John. Lovely. 1st of July this year. Yes, very convincing. EastEnders' first ever drag queen is due to sashay to Albert Square as a regular character. Fans have been given a sneak peek at Tora Mizu, played by Matthew Morrison. Again, look at the toleration of LGBT among the black community, shall we? Matthew said it was a privilege to showcase the creative art of drag to viewers and the residents of Watford, and to represent the LGBTQIA+ community. It's important for people to feel reflected on screen. Now, for some reason, drag queens are everywhere at the moment, and they keep mixing up the pronouns. It's almost like they're equating them with trans, which is weird because it's almost calling gender a costume again, which I'm sure women would have objected to in the same way that black people would object to white people wearing shoe polish in a minstrel show. Yeah, strange. Lucas Young, a drag queen by the name of Miss Klasperges, which seems to be making fun of autistic people. Thanks for that. Who uses the pronouns she, they, which is weird because it's literally a costume, says it's significant for a show as big as EastEnders to be, quote, unapologetically dealing with these issues. It could have a big impact, Lucas feels, as growing up, they didn't see much representation on TV. Quote, if I had that realization or opportunity from a younger age,
drag
I feel...
Drag queens?
Yeah.
Right, well, people are always in drag on TV.
There's a difference between the sort of pantomime dame approach and the drag queens, which, and I covered this in a video for the website called The Killer Clowns of Leftism, the approach written by a drag queen and academic called Little Miss Hot Mess that says that drag is a pedagogic tool for bringing queer ways of knowing into the imaginations of children, and, quote, we will leave a trail of glitter that will never come out of the carpet. So it's a way of ideologically activizing young people into the LGBT movement, not just being gay, not being freedom of expression, but using your sexuality to wage a revolution against the straight white male hegemony. Again, they're raising consciousness in a group of people they define as black and saying, aren't you different from the whites? You should wage war. Now they're using the same thing for gay people, drag queens, etc. It's all about politics. It's not about identity. So he said, the only way we can normalize drag and the queer community is to talk about it and make people aware of the people we are. And he said, I feel like I would have been able to begin creating more if I would have seen myself. Knowledge is power. And there is the mask off moment. It's not about representation or honesty. It's about power. As I said, political influence. So they're not creating this character to be authentic. They're creating this to reach through the screen and slap you and say, we are now in control. You should accept it. It's very dark stuff. There's a promo for this. We should watch the promo.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Mitch, sort of anti-Karen.
Sorry, what?
You're gonna kill yourself!
now!
I'm prepared to die for my ride!
Did someone call for a drag queen? Salter, down. Oh, golly.
So notice there for our viewers, it says Walford Fit for a Queen. It's got the racial pride flag in there. And for those who don't know, the newly adopted racial pride flag has the traditional conservative pride flag of the rainbow intersected by a triangle from the left, which has the trans flag of white, pink and blue, and then a black and brown stripe. Do you know what that black and brown stripe stands for?
No.
Black and brown people. So they're literally segregating people by race and sexuality in their own flag. Again, it's not about equality. It's not about acceptance. It's about creating grievance groups in society and agitating them and then putting them on screen to increase their level of power relative to their proportion of the population. And they're using this to speak to normal working people who clock off work at 5 o'clock and watch this over dinner to say, this is the reality now, accept it. It's very dark.
So. How many people watch EastEnders these days?
I don't actually know the viewing figures. I'm not sure. But I would assume that the viewing demographic of younger people is not particularly large because most young people don't watch terrestrial television. Increasingly few people are switching off their license fee. Increasingly more people are switching off the license fee. Increasingly few people are tuning into things like the BBC. So I think this is targeted at an old demographic.
Yeah. My kids, I've got four, and they watch telly all the time. The youngest only ever watches sport.
Mm.
The next one, actually, she hardly watches any. She just listens to watches classical music on YouTube. And then, the eldest girl, who is 20, watches TV all the time. But, you know, on demand.
Netflix, so, things like that.
Netflix. But she will watch a lot of stuff on iPlayer. She will watch a lot of series on iPlayer. And the eldest one watches quite a bit as well. But they'll never watch it in real time. And I don't believe they've ever watched it. They probably don't even know what EastEnders is.
Mm.
They'll watch like a funny sitcom or something.
Yeah, but it's attempts to, obviously, they're more aware and in touch with
Peaky Blinders or something they'd watch.
Mm. They have more of the politics accessible at their fingertips. But this is more targeted at Gen X, boomers, octogenarians who are on social media significantly less in touch with platforms like ours, who don't parrot the mainstream narrative, and instead they get their political worldview through narratives. And the critical race theorists knew the power of narrative. Charles R. Lawrence III wrote a thing called The Word and the River, and he said, literally, quote, we must flood the airways with our narratives to try and alter your perception of reality to believe that the marginal identities like LGBT or racial minorities are suddenly the dominant identities, and that's why they should have more political power specifically over you.
None of this would be possible if the state did not have, if we separated money and state, because there would not be the money to pay for it all.
Nope, and you wouldn't have the broadcasters. It would be cut off at the tax.
In the same way that that PayPal has cut off the free speech union, we should cut off the state by using non-state money.
Defund the BBC. Lovely.
Now, just on the subject of the BBC, one of the things that goes on, you know, there's this whole thing of, I think it was the Halifax on Twitter started using its pronouns, and then somebody complained, and the guy on Twitter
just said,
if you
don't
like it, don't bank with it. And it had spent years trying to build up its customer base. And, you know, there is this attitude that the customer is always right, and you should do what you can to please your customer. Obviously, the customer can be an a-hole sometimes. But I think what happens with the BBC is it's got this huge captive market in the age range of 45 up to 100 or whatever it is. It's you know, probably half the population.
Hmm.
I don't know that. I'm making it up. But let's say it's something like that. Everyone over the age of 45, and particularly everyone over the age of 60, it's just got, particularly Radio 4, it's just got this huge captive market. And I feel that with a lot of the decisions, the BBC, you know, they're always going, oh, we need to get more young people on board. Well, young people don't listen to Radio 4. Mm. They don't watch the BBC except maybe on iPlayer or Match of the Day or whatever it is. They don't watch TV in real time. And I feel like because the customer of the, you know, the TV tax, the license fee is taken and it's not voluntarily given and then it's handed to the BBC, the customer, which is the viewer, loses power in that dynamic. It's a bit like the NHS. The doctor is not directly accountable to the patient when the patient should have the power of the customer, and he doesn't. And so, you know, the NHS is totally weighed in favour of the supplier rather than the customer.
Yeah.
And a much more natural market dynamic is, you know, the customer the customer seller, if you like.
Yeah.
And the BBC has just lost touch with its customers.
As well, they are their journalistic charity enterprises arm, which isn't funded by a state license.
Yeah,
license fee is predominantly given by organisations like the Gates Foundation.
Well, that too.
So there are ideological interests at work.
I'll say, and it's full of producers that think they know better.
Yeah,
and it's thick. For many of its producers, the customer of the BBC is a problem that needs to be brushed away, and it gets in the way of the smooth running of the organisation. And they're just this frothy people from Tunbridge Wells who don't know any better.
I was once told by a producer on a network I will not name that slow down, don't use as many big words because our audience are stupid. Direct quote. So they do regard you with utter contempt. They see you as someone to be ideologically propagandised to. So if we look next at The Sun, I remember watching this clip live and was utterly dismayed. There was a encounter between this nurse here, Ash, and this woman in the wheelchair, and the exact dialogue was she offered her treatment for a shortness of breath, and the woman said, "I want someone from here," and the nurse said, "I am from here," and the old woman said, "No, I mean really from here," and she said, "Oh, well, you don't think I'm from here," and the old woman went, "Oh, I just want someone else," and it's meant to be, and she had a really bad day in the episode, it's meant to be, "Oh, the pervasive racism that's everywhere, it's attacking our glorious NHS, don't you feel sorry for the doctors?" And it's like, okay, obviously this character is a reprehensible person, she's an actual racist. But the number of encounters that happen like this in everyday life are so astronomically low. And if we look at somewhere like Leicester at the moment, for example, it's more likely that you're going to have inter-ethnic conflict of a religious notion between the Hindus and the Muslims than you are a racist or white lady saying, "Oh, don't save my life because you're brown." Utterly ridiculous.
That was quite funny listening to this monologue by some guy in the Leicester riots, Muslim guy, and he was ranting on and he had a balaclava over his face so that you could only see his eyes.
Yeah.
And he was going, "I've got it in for the Hindus. But, you know, the Hindus who are from England, they're okay. But it's the Hindus who are coming over here and doing all of that." And it was like,
Look
at yourself. Look at the irony, man.
Yeah, exactly. If we go to the next one as well, EastEnders are pushing critical race theory books. They're literally saying that the white guy, they played it off as a bit cheesy, but the white guy in trying to understand his interracial relationship bought the book Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race.
In EastEnders?
In EastEnders. That's a shot from the... Yeah, literally.
Oh, that's a bit of product placement, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also a critical race theory book which says that black and white people can't talk to each other. And as I said to you, they're trying to raise resentment without the ability for us to talk between groups. And so what's the only way of resolving conflict? Then it's violence. They just think they're going to win. So then they have a Muslim convert storyline. And this is from Bobby Beale, who a few years ago, about 5 years ago now, the storyline was he'd killed his sister, gone to prison. He comes out of prison and now he's reformed because he's converted to Islam. And there's an article here. He's now dating a girl, by the way, whose dad and brother are rampant Islamophobes. So the storyline is, obviously, there's a Romeo and Juliet style intolerance against Islam, even though he's a convicted killer. There are an estimated 80,000 converts to Islam in Britain, with their growing number by 5,000 every year, yet many are still treated with suspicion. EastEnders' Bobby Beale character has converted to Islam, and the faith is being presented as a positive influence in his life. This is overdue. Converts to Islam are one of the fastest growing religious communities in the UK, but they often make headlines for all the wrong reasons, whether it's Oxford-born Jack Letts' ISIS link, or a contentious tweet by newly converted singer-songwriter Sinead O'Connor. Muslim converts are generally met with an air of suspicion, or in many cases, open hostility. So this is, again, clearly not done for an authentic storyline. It's done because, boom, the message, accept Muslim converts. As post-colonial pre-Brexit Britain wrestles with the existential questions of what it means to be British, we should look to learn from Muslim converts who have been able to straddle multiple identities, identities that are often presented as conflicting. As someone embedded in grassroots Muslim communities, the person who writes this, I'm acutely aware that that converts represent the future of Islam in Britain. Reads like a bit of a threat. That's why I am less concerned with the quantity of people coming to my religion than I am with the quality of both their faith and their journey to go through Muslim communities. Every one of these journeys is different, but none of them should end in ISIS-held Syria. Oh, I can agree with that last point, absolutely. But then let's look at how they express that journey, shall we? Far-right extremists Neil and Aaron plan to bomb the mosque in disturbing scenes. So the dad and brother the dad and brother of his girlfriend, the Muslim convert, are planning to bomb a mosque and blame it and try and... It's basically a plot of Four Lions where Barry goes, bomb the mosque, radicalise the moderates. That was meant to be a parody. You weren't meant to take it seriously. Come on. But also, how often does that happen when the other way around, if we look at the proportion of terrorist attacks to religion, doesn't go quite in the narrative's favour, does it? So let's quickly jump to Coronation Street before we run out of time. Peter becomes a paranoid conspiracy theorist over Big Pharma. Peter Barlow was determined to get revenge on Mr. Thorne after discovering how poorly he behaved before, during, and after his liver transplant in Coronation Street. The storyline was largely about the class system. For Peter, he was angry at a man like Thorne, privileged, rich, and well-educated, and how he could use his higher status to get away with hideous crimes, and continue to look down on a man like Peter, a former alcoholic who works as a taxi driver. So you can see how they're saying, oh, it's acceptable because it's about class. It's about prejudice. It's about workers versus the greedy capitalists. So that's an acceptable narrative. But then Peter's life takes another turn next week as he meets Griff, Spider's mate, who has some very interesting views on big pharmaceutical conspiracies. Should we look at what one of their characters thinks about Big Pharma? Let's listen to first clip, shall we?
Yeah, you know, I thought the Gazette would have made more of yesterday's protest.
Yeah, well, they report what they want to report.
Well, it was a pretty big deal.
Question is, who owns the media?
I don't know. Who does?
Well, that's the point. They don't want you to know. The media, banks, big business, they're all in it together, a secret global cabal.
And who exactly is this secret global cabal?
Who knows? Tell you one thing. Not like you and me. Yeah. Keep the change.
Okay, so he not only gives her a tip, it's also ironic that the first few letters of Coronation Street spell Corona, as he's talking about the secret conspiracy of lockdowns. But we also do know who does this, and it's the likes of the World Economic Forum, the UN, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, these giant hedge funds that prop up wokeness and climate initiatives with lots and lots of money, more money than most countries have in their possession. And so it's not an evil conspiracy theory levelled at a particular ethnic group or minority. It's, hey, here are these weird institutions that are funding wokeness. And funnily enough, they seem to be funding these programs. But did you know if you suggest that, like you and me might say, oh, the WEF are an unaccountable, unelected body, just as the EU, we couldn't elect them and they're having control over our lives. It's no different from Brexit to say they shouldn't be intervening. Do you know that you and me are anti-Semitic for saying that?
How's that?
Well, let's watch this clip, shall we?
He's a bit of a weird one, that Griff. So, do you think there's a secret cabal of powerful people who secretly run the world? Might be. Really? No. You know, I love a conspiracy theory as much as the next girl, but it can be dangerous. Dangerous how? Like the MMR vaccine causes autism. A lot of kids went unprotected. A lot of them got really ill. Do you know what? Some nights, when it's clear, I look up and I think, did we really land on the moon? You know, apparently it was a big thing back then. But we've not gone back, have we? Clearly it wasn't that great. Yeah, and Griff's secret cabal owning the media and banks is also a classic anti-Semitic trope. He didn't say it like that, though, did he? No, but it's not the best rabbit hole to go down. I don't trust him. Look, I'm worried that microchip they put in you with your COVID vaccine's malfunctioning.
You're a pound short.
One day, all money will be meaningless.
Really?
This coin only has meaning because we agree it has meaning. When in reality, it's no more valuable than a shiny button.
Are you going to give me a lecture?
No. I want to give you a pound.
Thank you.
I like Griff. He talks a lot of sense.
Fantastic ending. Okay.
It's funny, Coronation Street.
Again, it's they're not giving you a storyline. They're saying, don't think for yourself, don't question things. And also, Griff's kind of right about money, as you said, with fiat currency. It's been utterly debased. It has no gold standard anymore. The government are just printing it. How do you think we're in this position of inflation, folks? It's because they just printed money to death during the COVID pandemic to pay for the furlough scheme. And so what's he wrong about? But no, we're just going to dismiss him as an anti-Semite, even though he never mentioned Jewish people whatsoever. Isn't that inconvenient? They're also persecuting their own stars for real-life conspiracy theories. They've complained about star Sean Ward having an outrageous conspiracy theory, and it's to do with Zelensky, and just saying, well, he doesn't really seem like he's on the up-and-up. Might seem like he got some money from some strange sources, like, I don't know, the Biden family, when Joe Biden literally admits to saying, yeah, unless you fire the prosecutor looking into my son's business dealings, you won't get the $1 billion. Okay. Yeah, but conspiracy theory, as per usual. I don't know whether or not this guy is an upstanding guy, but he's allowed to think for himself. And then if you weren't convinced that the networks are actually joining forces to sell you a narrative...
I'm going to defend that Coronation Street clip. I thought it was all right. I thought it was quite balanced.
What, her just dismissing it as an anti-Semitic
show? Yeah, but that was one character. And then you had another character that was going... I mean, that is the...
Yes, but they're setting up that character to be indoctrinated and make an example of. That's the thing.
Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but I
well, that's the character I mentioned before from the article saying it's Peter Barlow's falling down a conspiracy theory rabbit hole. The guy that said he makes a lot of sense, that's Peter.
Okay.
Yes, they're setting it up. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, they're setting up to make him a fool as a shining example of why you shouldn't listen to these dangerous voices. Yeah, if you don't believe they aren't all coordinating to sell you a line, here's the next one. British soaps and continuing dramas join forces to highlight climate change. So we're all working together.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's...
For the first time in British television history, the country's soaps and continuing dramas have joined forces to highlight the issue of climate change and the environmental issues, and this was on the eve of COP26. This was Casualty, Coronation Street, Doctors, EastEnders, Emmerdale, Holby City and Hollyoaks have all filmed scenes or have references to covering climate change and reference each other for the first time ever. This was on Monday the 1st of November in last year, and Jane Hudson, on behalf of Emmerdale and ITV Studios, said, "Never before have all five soaps and continuing dramas come together and united in telling one story. We certainly haven't seen characters pop up in other shows before. This is a real treat for our audience, whilst also allowing us to get across a very important message." That's what it's all about. It's to propagandise you. So, if you're a soap viewer and you're sick of this nonsense, go to Ofcom, make a complaint. It's the Government Regulation Board. Doesn't mean they'll necessarily do anything about it, but that's one of the only avenues you can have to make your voice heard. Or alternatively, you can sign up to our website and become a premium member for as little as £5 a month and see a narrative that is quintessentially British that hasn't been corrupted by the most terrible of messages. This was actually written by Terry Jones from Monty Python. It's Beau and I discussing life lessons from Labyrinth. And I decided to include this at the end of the segment because not only does my mum love soaps, this is her favourite film, so I did it in her honour. So, and I really can say this is my favourite bit of content we've done. So simply tune out if they're going to berate you and call you an anti-Semite. Watch things that don't talk down to you. And quite simply, you're not getting your message across in a very authentic way if rather than characters, you're just making them be political pawns. Quite boring, actually.
My ex-wife's favourite film.
Oh, good. Oh, well, I don't know if that's slightly bittersweet to say, but there you go. Okay, let's go on to the comments then. A little honourable mention from Ron Swansea. "Great to see Dominic back on the podcast as someone who works in financial services. It's great to see a prominent figure not going along with, quote, the message. On your point about PayPal not allowing us to withdraw in other currencies, there is a way to make payments in other currencies by going through settings. I'd be surprised if you can't make it work with withdrawals. I pay for a lot of things in euros and our band lives in Spain. I've not had a problem using my Monzo account to pay directly from in euros from PayPal's perspective. So there might be a way to get around
that." I think... Okay, you can hold dollars and euros and whatever in PayPal. Mm. I haven't tried to do this recently, but I tried to do it about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
If I had US dollars in my PayPal account, I couldn't withdraw them to my UK US dollar account.
Yes.
I would have to translate them into pounds first.
Manually converted, and PayPal takes their cut. I've run across that before, being paid by US dollars.
I stand corrected if they're right.
Based Ape, "I love Dominic's phrasing, the cost of government. It addresses the exact issue and doesn't hide the problem behind weasel phrasing like the cost of living. It's not living that's driving up prices and preventing us buying homes. It's government's awful policies and reckless spending. This phrase needs to be pushed into the common parlance and used at every opportunity. The cost of government crisis is ruining our countries." And God, is that true? Lord Nerevar, who had the pleasure of meeting down at the Queen's funeral, funnily enough, "There is that one pillar of fascism, corporatism, that seems to be the most important one now. The government enforcing its policy through the corporations who can exercise power the government lacks. It's a loophole into authoritarianism, and it's probably why they're so bold about denouncing their political rivals." Question from Drew to you. What's the best way to acquire Bitcoin?
What's the best way to buy it?
Yes.
Exchange, there's a million different exchanges.
Do you advise taking it off the exchange? Because
Okay.
Generico 101, demoralization, destabilization, crisis. You are here, normalization. Seems to be correct on the roadmap. You've encouraged someone to close their PayPal account. So William Snechter just says, never used it anyway, but not going to anymore. Free Will 2112. "All of the big tech Silicon Valley companies are facilitators of the coming feudalism. They are part of the new robber baron class." Edward Bay, "Regardless of its environmental impact, Bitcoin depends on the availability of electricity. No electricity equals no Bitcoin. Government control of electricity also means they can shut down mining at any time." And that's a very valid point. That's why if renewables ever does work very spurious as to whether or not they're sustainable. But if everyone gets a solar panel or a wind turbine in their back garden, then you have your own self-sustaining economy, don't you?
Yeah, if you look at a map, there's a map that I think it's Bitcoin Magazine or one of those things on Twitter documenting Bitcoin or something has shown. And it's a map of Bitcoin mining around the world. And it is totally distributed. There's obviously places where energy is cheap that it's slightly denser, bits of North America and China, but it is so distributed. Bitcoin mining happens pretty much everywhere except Saharan Africa. And so it is a truly decentralized, distributed currency.
On to comments about the Patriot Act segment first. Baron von Warhawk, Antifa spends half a year burning down the country in 2020. The Taliban now has $85 billion worth of equipment because of Joe's incompetence. Gang shooters in Detroit and Chicago are now more dangerous than in Kabul. The alt-right had a frat party in a Capitol building and took a dump on Nancy Pelosi's desk. Yeah, the alt-right is the biggest threat to America right now. It wasn't even the alt-right. It was just grandmas walking around the Capitol building waving flags because they were let in. January 6th was not the new 9/11, shockingly enough.
That has been so misconstrued, January 6th is an extraordinary.
There was one death. It was Ashley Babbitt, and the cop got away with it despite shooting into a crowd of civilians without looking. Not very responsible. And then one comment from the soap propaganda section. Just at the top here. Ewan Baker, I'm 32. I used to listen to Radio 4 in my car, but in the end I got fed up with all the woke stuff and biased interviews, and that's how I think a lot of people feel, actually. They brought back BBC 3 for the younger crowd, and again, they've got totally rubbish ratings because it's just all race propaganda.
But there's an audience who would love to listen to BBC 3, but they've all gone over to Classic FM.
Yeah, don't blame them. On that note, thank you very much for joining me, Dominic. Have you got anything to mention or promote?
Yes, I do have something to plug. I've got two things to plug, actually. The first is, you mentioned Ofcom there. I've got a new song coming out, Ofcom's Unacceptable Words. It's very amusing, so look out for that on YouTube. It's going to be in the next few days. And then next week, the 28th and the 29th of September, I'm doing a show in London. It's a lecture with funny bits called How Heavy, all about the history of weights and measures. Mm. And I promise you, it will change the way we perceive the world through measurements. And I began the lecture fairly ambivalent about weights and measures, but I've become a bit more militant, but it will change. It's an incredibly interesting subject. And that's at the Museum of Comedy, September the 28th and 29th at 7 p.m. So please come along if you're free.
Brilliant. Am I also right in thinking you briefly met Jordan Peterson?
I did last week.
Yeah. I'm so envious.
I dinner with him.
That's so cool. That's fantastic.
Had steak with him.
Oh, gutting, a genuine personal hero. But thanks very much for coming back.
Always a pleasure
to be on with you. Join us again at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Until then, this is Dominic, and I'm Connor. That's all from us at the Lotus Eaters. Goodbye.